there's a race between science and ethics. It involves, in part, biobanks, bioethics, and personalized cancer medicine. How should we proceed as expectations rise and personalized genetic cancer care becomes a product? Hi, welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. practicalbioethics.org. Glenn McGee joins us. He is the John B. Francis Chair in Bioethics at the Center and the Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Bioethics. Glenn, you just presented on these issues at MD Anderson in Houston. I guess a basic question to begin here is, how must ethics lead in this environment?
Well, MD Anderson is a great example of an institution that kind of characterizes what we love about American medicine. There are a few places that everybody turns to when there's a very, very difficult problem in their family or their personal life, and those institutions lead globally. They lead in two ways. One, they cut the edge, on the bleeding edge sometimes, cutting edge other times, in terms of new research. That means they offer those patients, Americans and Kuwaitis and others, the top of the line in what's coming, what we now refer to often as translational research. And the other piece is that there are a few institutions around the United States that in different areas are understood to be centers for excellence in terms of their clinical care. And so, you know, I was stunned, even though it was Texas, to find MD Anderson's parking lot was actually bigger than the parking lot for the baseball stadium. There are just literally thousands. It's like a honeycomb there and, for that matter, anywhere today where new medicine is being practiced. And that means that those institutions have a special opportunity globally to not just develop new things like personalized medicine for cancer patients, but also as they develop them, to lead by publishing to their peers and patients, here's what we do, here's why, here's some of the issues that we've faced, and what does that mean going forward? To me, that's what bioethics is also about. And so I'm always happy when a big institution embraces that leadership role.
What are the issues that we're talking about here? We're talking about biobanks, bioethics, personalized cancer medicine. What are the ethical issues that we're trying to weigh?
Well, you know, in one sense, there's nothing new under the sun. Personalized medicine is the nature of medicine itself. It's almost adding an unnecessary word to call medicine personalized, because there is no more personal relationship than the one between a physician and a doctor. And what we all hope for is that our clinician will be not only focused on us, but attuned to our particular problems and what specific doses we should take and when we should take them, since we work at night or whatever. But personalized medicine is also a phenomenon. And I think the critical shift in medicine in the last 5 years, but also in the map that's been laid out by our U.S. National Institutes of Health and by most of the major societies in medicine, is a shift toward literally describing a science program whereby through genes, an examination of health histories of hundreds of thousands of patients, often obtained by using tissue samples that they give, but sometimes just by asking them questions. Gathering that information together can create databases that allow personalized medicine in this new sense, where literally the kind of compound or drug that's given to you or the device that's given to you comes from this new science of thinking of drugs as not one size fits all, but rather one size fits one. So, you know, you will, in the future of cancer, you will no longer have ovarian cancer. You will have, you know, XQ45. And in other words, you will literally be identified by the mutation that you have. And so the definition of disease is at stake, it really. And families, whole families, will know a lot more about when things are going to hit. And doctors will be able to communicate a lot more information. And that together is perhaps the most complicated change in medicine that one could ever envision, because gathering those samples to make medicine personalized involves asking people to give up what is as personal as it gets, you know, their body, their data about what made them them. We've told people for 20 years now that they are their genes, right? So now people like MD Anderson, but I don't mean to single them out, basically every major medical institution and many states are engaged in building health information exchanges, and they're selling that information in appropriate ways, we hope, to get everything from the records of what you bought from Q-tips at you know, CVS, all the way down to the MRI results that you had 10 years ago, so that the personalized piece of medicine is also a gargantuan database for everybody else.
So let's get this down to the personal level if we can here. Say that I'm a patient and I'm donating something in some way, and I have a sense that this may benefit me personally, directly, and I may have a continuing interest in that piece of tissue after harvesting, especially after I might pay for a genetics test, as an example. What are the ethical issues that we're wrestling with in that kind of a scenario?
Well, at the front end, they have to do with the messy parts. It's always been the case that when you went to a hospital, you left something on the floor. No cleaner way to put it than that, no pun intended. Those tissues and materials that are involved in everything from operations to routine blood draws have often, and in fact probably always in 20th century medicine, been considered to be appropriate subjects for research within a hospital to improve its own quality of care. We often refer to that as in-hospital epidemiology. That, though, has a much more limited goal. And when you leave the bits and parts that you leave in an operation, those things ranging from placenta to bones are not then used by hospitals for large-scale research. This larger scale program of health sector databases, and I should just pause for a second and say, if I use a term to describe the big picture of health sector databases and then try to give a name to it, somebody's not going to recognize that name. I mean, literally, there are more names for what to call these giant repositories than anything else. They share in common, though, the fact that it's that tissue that's left someplace or that someone harvests with your permission, that tissue is now considered not as tissue but as information. So the cellular material that's there, the proteins that are there, the genes that are there, they are, you know, as it were, ones and zeros, A, C, G, and T, they are data. And thinking of your body as data, you know, if you watch The Matrix, it doesn't stun you too much. But for most people, it's a little surprising and jarring. Around the United States, when patients are asked, would you like to participate in health sector databases and so on, roughly 40 to 60% say, sure, absolutely, I'd be happy to, when they're in a hospital and someone asks them or their general physician asks them. What was unique about cancer care that I've discovered in the last few weeks of research is that upwards of 99% of cancer patients say yes to providing material. That may not be all that surprising. I mean, after all, lots of people who seek specialized cancer care are at the end of their clinical options. They've run out of other things to do. They feel very grateful. They want to advance science in the future. But isn't that true of all Americans? I mean, it's been the tradition of American research that one of the reasons we do so well is that people will volunteer themselves, their stuff, their money, whatever, to make things push forward. So what happens then is that after they've donated that material, one way or another, they realize that there are some risks and hazards to them that they might not have considered. For example, if the material that you've given to a healthcare institution results in a cure for something, that cure will result in millions and millions and millions and millions and millions and billions of dollars.
And lots of green.
Lots of green. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are a number of relatively famous cases. The Lacks, Henrietta Lacks.
I was just thinking about that case.
So the public is reading about that and they're thinking about that. They're thinking about whether or not an individual might not be recognized appropriately when their tissue helped cure umpteen different diseases. And when people give material, they now often say, well, I want you to keep me informed about whether or not my genes helped you cure X or my genes helped you diagnose Y.
Now, are those questions being asked as a way, thinking of a way of making money? Or is it something just out of general interest that I was able to contribute to science in a way that was able to lead to a great breakthrough?
Well, really, it's a rubber meets the road thing. What physicians are telling us is that when people do agree, that they make odd requests. So, for example, they'll say, I'm happy to give you my genetic material, but I'd like you to ship a third of it off to the hospital in Haifa because I have a longstanding relationship there. And by extension, trust them, and I know they'll help monitor it. And so what we're seeing are very odd, specific request for control over the data that comes out of your body. People are recognizing that giving to an anonymous institution, even if 99% of them will give to, you know, Memorial Sloan Kettering, they still want to know what's going to happen. It's less a theoretical problem than it is practical because it's impossible to track information that way. When people built these health sector databases that our own state of Missouri, for example, has just bid out to a contractor, and lots of other states around the country are bidding out, they too face this because when bureaucrats ask for tissue, whether it's mandatory newborn screening or literally having doctors now say, we'd like to use your health records, it's a little threatening to people, and they then try to regain control. We've taught Americans now for more than a decade and a half that autonomy is the primary value in healthcare. So it hits them when we talk about it as a research problem. There's also another piece to this that's a little bit dicey. Enough people know enough about genetics now to realize that when you give genetic information to someone, not only are they likely to have some benefit to the institution, which they're fine with, but it's also likely that they'll find out something about that information at some point in the future. So, you know, there are direct-to-consumer genetics companies now that are happy to sell you genetic tests, as you know, to give you genetic information directly. You pay for that, and then they keep updating you as they find out more about what your genes mean. For $200, you can send your DNA off to 23andMe, and they'll keep telling you by iPhone what's going to happen. In these cases, though, if I give genetic material to a cancer center and it turns out in an unrelated article in a science journal that the gene that I found out that I had for my cancer also happens to be the gene that is directly related to having a child with Down syndrome or to having a child with Huntington's, or you know, just pick your disease because it'll be something unpredicted, or to my early onset Parkinson's that I otherwise wouldn't expect, then what right do I have to come back to you as the institution that asked me for this data in the first place and say, hey, I want you to tell me about it? They're not prepared for that in the heart institution, you know, at Temple and Philadelphia.
Should they be prepared for that?
I think they probably should be. And I think one of the biggest challenges here is going to be in training scientists in research ethics. We do a terrible job of that. And, I don't even think it's bioethics' fault. I think I've often said that teaching research scientists about ethics is today where teaching doctors about ethics was in the 50s. We do a terrible job. We give most scientists in training roughly 2 to 4 hours of ethics training, and during that time we tell them that they ought not be very, very bad boys. They shouldn't paint mice. They shouldn't lie. They shouldn't steal data. That, you know, it's kind of a litany of lessons that if you didn't learn them in the sandbox already, you're not going to learn them in grad school. We have to now begin to develop leadership standards to teach scientists who are asking patients and teach physicians who are asking on behalf of scientists to teach them about these kinds of issues. But the difficulty is, We don't know what the issues are yet. So we can literally gather hundreds of millions of samples of DNA in the United States. Framingham Heart Study has been following people for decades, and it's one of the largest of the databases that's now being mined for DNA. Those folks are familiar. You know, go to Framingham, Massachusetts, and ask a grandmother whether or not she's willing to give tissue. They've been studying people in Framingham about heart attacks and heart disease forever. But if you go to Kansas City or to Chicago or to New York and ask them a question about whether or not they'd be willing to give information, the physician doesn't know what to say. The patients don't know how to answer, and all they really know about DNA is OJ and, you know, are they going to find out that their kid isn't really their kid? What are they going to hear about the future of this information? In the past, if somebody asked you to do a test, you got a result. Here, you're being asked to just give to a giant museum of the human species what Carl Sagan would have said is an Encyclopedia Galactica.
Well, I framed this at the beginning as a race between science and ethics. And in a race, you have an official, a referee. And in the case of what we're talking about here, does it simplify it too much if what we're really seeking is who will be the referee and how does that referee need to be educated to identify the things that we don't know about yet?
I don't think that's oversimplification. I think that the truth is that probably the old adage that since about the 1960s, science has raced ahead of ethics has more truth in it than anyone wants to admit. There are two big failings for us that we have to address. One of them has to do with the fact that most Americans, when they're in a hospital setting, turn to clergy. Most Americans are religious. Most Americans have deep-seated values about healthcare, and most clergy and chaplains in particular know diddly-doo about bioethics. And so that's not to suggest that we need to bring in the bioethics experts, because on the other hand, bioethics has become a discipline and an area of research. And so while, you know, I can be as helpful as I can be in suggesting pitfalls that will be faced, I'm at 30,000 feet and I'm not a minister and I'm not going to be engaged actively with those people except in as much as I train clergy. There's a gap. And so when people portray ethics as like running this, you know, sprint to catch up with science, they're not wrong. The scientists make it impossible for us. They publish these books that say, you know, Craig Venter famously published a book about his own DNA after it was revealed that his DNA map was his own DNA and that he had literally completed most of the Human Genome Project privately in his own labs. Venter famously being kind of a renegade and unusual character with his DNA, and he was really excited about all that he was going to find out. When he published that, he scared the bejeebers out of people. And Americans are scared of science. And the fear of science largely is about the fear of scientists, not of science generally. A very good example of this for people to keep in mind is the falsehood that we all believe about genetically modified foods. Americans think that, you know, GMOs, you know, this, you know, the fact that everything in the grocery store you see is now artificial in one way or another, that that's somehow the reason that Europeans fear it so much and everybody else around the world fears it so much is because they're scared of science. It's not that. They're scared of DuPont, and they shouldn't be, but they are. They're scared of recklessness or a lack of sufficient monitoring and training. And there, even though companies like DuPont have led the way in training and so on, the fear of America is not entirely unfounded. We rush ahead with projects. It's how we're the scientific leaders of the world. But at the same time, other countries are cleaning up our mess. Britain in particular, with its Economic and Social Research Council, is expending literally hundreds of millions of dollars studying ethical issues in biobanking. For us to catch up there, for us to play a leadership role, and by us I mean not just American institutions but bioethics around the world, for us to speed science up to catch up with science, bioethics to catch up with science, we're going to have to get our hands dirty, learn science, bring scientists into bioethics more than they already are, and create new rules and new ways of thinking about healthcare so that patients aren't scared to participate in these efforts and physicians aren't scared to tell patients about the results.
Glenn McGee is the John B. Francis Chair in Bioethics at the Center for Practical Bioethics and the Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Bioethics. For more information, visit practicalbioethics.org, practicalbioethics.org. I'm Laurel LeBoo. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.